Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Yes, I am Michael Steele. I'm still around. You can't get rid of me that fast. But you know what you can do? You can go to Stitcher and TuneIn and Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcast on, and download us. We'd love to have you be a part of the Michael Steele podcast family. So tonight, today, tomorrow, this evening, in the moment, we've got a gentleman that I have a great deal of admiration for. He is probably one of the more principled voices out there, speaking in this, this era of, deconstruction of the administrative state, as it were. He's the former member of the U.S. House of Representatives representing Florida's 13th Congressional District, one and only David Jolly. Hey, David, welcome to the podcast, man.
It's great to be with you. You're very kind, but I'll take it.
No, dude. I, you know, it's a great pleasure to call you a colleague and buddy over at MSNBC. And
That's right. You're
one of the few voices on the Republican side or in the Republican space, because I know some folks are transitioning or have transitioned.
Although, look,
I'm just trying to get people to stay here in the house and help me keep at least one light bulb in, you know?
Michael, we're going to have a conversation. I got the question the other day. I did leave the party last September or so, and as we were talking, the reason being, my wife and I were expecting our first kid, and it forced me to think about things a little differently. But I got the question the other day, shouldn't you stay and try to save the party? And my response was, you know, what's left to save? And I hate to say that because I know you're still with the party. I'd love to have that conversation with you one day.
Well, I'll put this little bug in your ear, which will trip our conversation, so we'll make sure we have it. I look at it this way, and folks who follow me on the podcast know, because I've said this before, it's as if, you know, I come to your home. However I got there, either you invited me, I came as the guest of someone else, or I just Bogart my way up in the joint, right? But I'm in your house.
Right.
And, you know, things seemingly go along pretty well. But then I start breaking your family china. I start tearing down your curtains. And I start, you know, throwing food on the floor and pissing in the corner of your living room. Question. Do you leave or do you kick my ass out?
Well, so I would kick you out, but what if you brought 100 friends with you?
That's
because
all right.
I feel like that's what right. happened to the that's Republican right. Party.
Baby, it's like the Night King. It's not the Night King. You take out the Night King, the rest will fall. The rest will fall. So that's how that works. But no, I'd love to have that conversation with you because I meant what I said at the beginning, that you have been an incredibly salient and I think important voice coming from your experience as former general counsel to a member to being a member having you know been in the political space you understand and certainly from an important state like Florida you know how much this country is changing but you also know how I'll use the word and it's fairly strong I think but it's appropriate desperate a lot of Americans feel they are or have to be. And in the course of that desperation, in my estimation, they lose sight of that fundamental essence of what this country is about, is that we are stronger together. We are stronger
right.
when we think about those values, when we think about that lady in New York Harbor, when we think about how our parents raised us, and we think about how this country was formed despite its racist past and its misogynist past, and some will say even present. We still find resiliency to sort of forge through. And so how do you see that, whether inside or outside the party, that piece of kind of pushing the country to recognize, folks, this isn't the end game. We're just warming up.
Settle it down
a little bit, you know?
Well, and I like the way you frame that question, because you're right. I think we've learned from the time we were children that is what that bonds us together, but that also there are moral truths in exactly what you just described. And as a nation, we try to reflect those. And what I believe very simply has happened with the emergence of Trumpism. Now, Trumpism was there, I would make the case, even before Donald Trump. There were elements of it. But what Trump the actor did, if you will, is he gave permission for us to give voice, almost to give equity to the contrarians to those values that our nation was founded on and that we teach our kids about. And he actually said, you know, the fine people on both sides, take it in the context of your question, you know, that conversations around institutionalized misogyny or racism are actually appropriate. He gave permission for those conversations to occur where in the past they hadn't. We teach our children away from those themes at a very early age. And we have political actors now that have given permission for those conversations to emerge again. And that's the concern, you know, the conversation about leaving the party and whether there's something to save. I had a conversation with a very well-respected Republican in the state of Florida. A history of public service will likely re-enter. He's not in office now. He pulled me aside the other day and he said, "Hey, I really appreciate what you're doing on TV, giving voice to your concerns about Trump." He said, "The fact is we do need a correction in the party and I'm glad you're doing it."
Yeah.
And I said to him, "Well," I said, "where's your voice? Because your voice matters a lot, frankly, more than David Jolly's." And he said, "Oh, I can't do that. I'm going to be on the ballot again." And I thought, if that's the best we got in the party, and then the worst is the voices of Charlottesville, and that was my point, what's left to save. And I know that's a pessimistic approach, right? Because there's the Michael Steele in the party as well, who I'll return the compliment, a man of principle. But that's what I struggle with the most, those voices that have agreed to be quiet in the face of what we're seeing.
It drives me absolutely, just absolutely maddeningly crazy over this whole thing when I hear members, currently elected officials, say that there is nothing greater than your service to the people of this country. There is no election or re-election that's more important. And I heard somebody say, "Well, if I'm not in the office, then I can't make the change and the difference." That's true. But you know what?
Right.
If you check your principles at the door, then no matter what bill you get passed or what law you enact, you are not serving the people. Because when you are in the crucible and you are called to stand up on principle, foundational principles about the rule of law, about the respect for the government processes that sort of help us manage and keep control over things, for those men and women who have committed their lives to public service in the FBI and the Justice Department and law enforcement, if you walk away from that, I don't care if you pass a health care bill. I don't care if you pass an infrastructure bill or appoint the right perfect Supreme Court justice. When you undermine the system, those things don't matter. And so that member, in my view, should be unelected. That member, in my view,
I agree with you. Look, we never like to question somebody's integrity, right? But the reality is, as voters, we do get to judge their integrity. I mean, that is just one of the evaluations we each make when it comes to our political leaders. And my wife and I call it the sleep well at night test. If you're in a position to act upon your own integrity and you ignore it, well, then voters get to judge that. But you know who else gets to reflect on that for the rest of their lives? The politician who is allowing their political future to become more important than their own personal integrity. And I promise you, you know from elected office, it lives with you for a long time.
It does.
When I was in office, you know, one of the issues that I have come full circle, 180-degree turn on, has been campaign finance. I would have made the case that if money is speech and, you know, should be unregulated. I'm in the public financing of campaigns now because I think it's so corrupted the process. When I decided to speak out about that in Congress, I knew I was heading for some trouble. And in fact, 60 Minutes did this profile on me. I said to the president of CBS News, just don't make me a whistleblower.
Yeah.
Well, he made me a whistleblower.
All right.
And for my wife and I, we were put in the wilderness. All right, House leadership didn't speak to me again. They largely abandoned me. And I was okay with that. It wasn't comfortable. But I look back now, and I wouldn't have done a single thing differently. In fact, I probably would have spoken out earlier once I really figured out how the gig is in.
Well, you raised an important word that has such incredible resonance in the last 24 hours and certainly the last couple of weeks, and that is integrity. And attached to that word, I would ask the question, what the hell happened to Bill Barr? We watched him yesterday as the sitting United States Attorney General before the Senate Judiciary Committee, as was noted, I think, in a number of press accounts, but Mimi Rocha, former prosecutor herself, noted, quote, looking at Barr's testimony as a whole, the most disappointing aspect was how he, once again, was willing to act more as President Trump's defense attorney, twisting legal and factual arguments in Trump's favor, which is not his job and is not how prosecuting decisions should be made. And it's appalling that he continues to perpetuate these extreme right-wing conspiracy theories, et cetera, et cetera. But the point of it was that he did not act as an attorney general. He acted as the president's own lawyer. And in fact, you have the headlines right now, David, are almost ones of resignation, where you see them saying things like Barr's testimony ensures Congress can't stop Trump now, that the wall is being effectively built, that as we build up this defense around the president, we literally are tearing down our own integrity of not just our justice system and judicial processes, but the impact it has on the country. What was your take from the Attorney General's testimony, and particularly in light that he has refused now to appear before the House committee to testify because he doesn't want to be questioned by lawyers? Such
right.
A poor
right.
Poor boo. Sorry to hear that.
You're right, and we'll get to this. I think the entire Trump administration has done wrong. They've embraced corruption. They are at fault as the actors of wrongdoing. But I think Democrats will either allow them to get away with it or not. And I don't think resignation by the Democrats is the right response. But here's the most generous interpretation I could give Bill Barr, and I actually don't believe it. But, John Yoo was, deputy attorney general counsel during the early days of the Bush administration when they were wrestling with the executive power around conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq and, frankly, torture against non-combatant or enemy combatants, if you will. And John Yoo took this strong view of executive authority and in doing so justified George Bush's behavior when it came to Guantanamo and other issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bill Barr, to draw an analogy, has convinced himself that he is a defender of a strong executive and that memo he wrote unsolicited and sent to the president, he actually did believe. I believe it was in part a job application for the AG job, but I think he believed that, in fact, the executive authority of the president is greater than some interpret it. That's the best possible license I can give him. And when he says he doesn't have to turn over the report, Legally, that's true. This was a special counsel of the Department of Justice, right. Not an independent counsel of the right. United States Congress. So those are the defenses. Now, does it justify how Barr's behaving? No, I think he has behaved wrongly at every turn. And I actually, my opinion, think he is intentionally engaging in obfuscation and obstruction, and he is coordinating it with the White House for the specific purpose of getting the president reelected. I think in the scrutiny of Kamala Harris's questioning yesterday, it is obvious that Barr has had these conversations with Donald Trump about not only how to protect the president, but how to target the president's likely rivals, including Joe Biden. We're going to see that story emerge. And Bill Barr put on full display that he's willing to lie to Congress. And as Nancy Pelosi just said, it is a crime what Bill Barr did. Now, Michael, I will tell you, I think Democrats have dropped the ball, and I put that on Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah.
They have never embraced this with the urgency that I think it commands. From the day the Mueller report hit, Nancy Pelosi should have called the Congress back from vacation, immediately opened impeachment inquiries, say we have enough evidence of likely obstruction from the Mueller report. We are going to have the inquiry now into the president. And even if they didn't do that, they should open an impeachment inquiry now into Bill Barr, saying he's obstructing the Congress by lying to it. They should open an impeachment inquiry into Steve Mnuchin, saying he is breaking the law by not turning over the president's taxes. This entire episode, not just for voters going into 2020 and for where we sit today, but also for all of history, will be defined by the gravity with which the Democrats clearly define it. This is their opportunity to define it. And in some ways, I feel like they've already missed the urgency, and this chapter might come to an end, ultimately with the suggestion that Democrats came down on the side of Bill Barr's interpretation of the Mueller report. Imagine that, Michael.
Yeah, that's interesting.
If the House Democrats don't move to impeach, what they are saying is that Bill Barr's interpretation of the 10 obstruction counts was right. Because Congress isn't going to move either. And certainly that cannot be the final outcome of this.
I think there's a lot of credence for all of your points with respect to impeachment. If you've decided that that is not just an uber political strategy, but more importantly, the appropriate judicial strategy, putting it in that context where you're acting on relevant information that would trigger the impeachment process, then it is better to do it now than to wait. There's no doubt about that, because I've not been a fan of the impeachment conversation or the idea. I think it's fraught with political peril for Democrats and for those who have real concerns about this president. Trump is going to use it as a badge of honor and wear it in such a way that every day he will use it to beat up his opponents. And we know that. But in light of the Mueller report, and particularly part two of the Mueller report, and I would encourage everyone, if you have not read even a synopsis of it, take the time to read the second part on obstruction of justice, because it will literally cause you to stop in your tracks and go, what the hell? And that's where I think you are, David. And the ultimate answer to that moment is, what is Congress going to do about this? And I think you've got to do it before September, because after that you get into full-throated presidential gamesmanship. You've got everyone distracted about the upcoming winter primaries. You've got all of these other little ancillary pieces that start to fall in place with respect to the presidential race. And I think now you've got the clearest runway. If you're going to pull that trigger and go down.
Go now.
You're going to have to do it.
But now. That's.
Yeah.
Democrats talk about, you know, they can walk and chew gum as the analogy of pursuing oversight while they're also pursuing policy. I couldn't disagree more strongly. I say approach it sequentially. Go now on an impeachment inquiry, whether you vote to impeach or not. Go now, have the national conversation with urgency. Cancel all the congressional recess breaks. Be in session Monday to Friday for the next 6 to 8 weeks. Go now with the hearings. Go now with the vote. Clear the deck by Labor Day and be done with it. And then spend the next year talking about healthcare, immigration, and taxes, and clear the decks for your 21 Democratic candidates to talk about policy, because even though it will be a defining issue of Trump's reelection, you and I both know that fortunately for the majority of voters, next November, they're not going to be talking about what we're talking about right now. The memories on politics are shorter than they are about matters related to family and faith in your workplace. So clear the deck of this constitutional matter so that the voters can focus on policy next November.
So what about the aspect of this that I also find somewhat annoying, and why, even in doing the taking the go down approach on impeachment, you still will run into the problem of getting the relevant parties at the table to stand there with their hands held, raised, in taking an oath to swear to tell the truth, et cetera, as that process begins. And I look at Mnuchin, whom you talked about refusing to acknowledge the subpoenas of the president's tax records. You look at the incredible performance of disdain and disrespect exhibited by Bill Barr in that committee hearing yesterday, then couple that with the effort at the moment to avoid appearing before the House. How then do you maneuver this? Because the president is sitting here saying, I'm now retroactively, even though I cleared the way and didn't have a problem with my staff and subordinates testifying, I'm now retroactively imposing executive privilege. I'm now forbidding anybody in my administration, not only to avoid the Washington Correspondents' Dinner, White House Correspondents' Dinner, but they're not going to go testify, you know, these things, the most important things first, you know. They're not going to go be allowed to testify before these committees when it's done. And then, of course, there is the sycophant of sycophants, one Lindsey Graham, who, as chairman of the Senate committee, emphatically decided this is done. We're not doing anything. It's over. So,
and admitted he hadn't read the report.
Hadn't read the report. But this is done. I don't need to know anything because Donald Trump has told me everything I need to think and know about the Mueller report.
Look, Michael, I would tell you, you don't need any of those actors for Congress to do its job. They don't have to take the oath. They don't have to testify. We see it in courtrooms all the time. People can choose not to testify. A verdict still gets handed down. And what I would tell you is that even empowers the work of the Congress. The American people understand simple concepts of cover-ups, right? Perhaps on collusion, it gets a little tricky. On obstruction, it's less tricky, right? He told Don McGahn to fire the person investigating them and then ordered him to lie about it. That's easy to understand as well. But when they say we need to see the president's taxes and we need to see them in 30 days, and Mnuchin says no, well, you're obstructing Congress. You're obstructing Congress doing its job, and we're going to impeach you for obstructing the United States Congress. You don't have to have Mnuchin testify. You don't have to have Barr testify. Nancy Pelosi just said that it is a crime. That was her word.
Yeah.
It was a crime what Bill Barr did by lying to Congress. Now, Speaker Pelosi, you cannot say the word crime and then not move to impeach him. You must. If the Attorney General of the United States committed a crime, and in particular in committing that crime obstructed the ability of the United States Congress to do their job, then what is the impeachment power for if not to be used in exactly this moment? Quit equivocating, quit hesitating, and do it. It's not a political calculus. It's a constitutional one.
So why the equivocation? That's my question. I mean, look, I get the politics on the back end, and I understand, like I said before, Trump is going to use it as a cudgel against Democrats, and he's going to be the martyr because he loves playing the martyr, because then everything's focused on him and it's about him, as all things should be in his world. So you know that. So I don't understand the hesitancy at this stage. You're right. If you stand up in the nation's bully pulpit in a full-throated press conference and say that a federal official as high as the Attorney General of the United States has committed a crime, then you would think the natural thing for you to do if you say that would be, okay, that would be like the police in your neighborhood going, yeah, we know Michael just committed a crime, but you know what? We just want to let people know he did it. That's all. We just want to let them know.
That's right.
We want to let everybody know
That's
Michael
right.
just stole, you know, just robbed the 7-Eleven. We know it. We actually right. have it on videotape. And in fact, we have Michael standing in front of a bank of cameras basically saying that he did it and daring us to do anything about it. But, you know, so we just wanted
That's
to let
right.
you know that.
Listen, Nancy Pelosi is not going to be defined fully by this moment. She is a remarkable legislator. I have great respect for her. A remarkable and historic career as being the first female speaker and now speaker twice. But as for this moment, my concern and my deep belief is she is fully unprepared for this moment.
Yeah.
And it is a fair question as to whether she has the strategy to get the nation through this. Because as I said earlier, this entire episode is defined by the response of the House Dems. If it is not a response of urgency and gravity, then it will forever be remembered in history as such, that just a minor blip of an investigation that turned out, as the president says, no collusion and no obstruction. If Congress moves to swiftly hold the administration accountable and to assign culpability and penalties and, yes, impeachment, then that is how this issue will be defined.
So you at one point in our conversation talked about how you launch this, you do it, you get it over by Labor Day, and then you can spend time talking about health care and all the other very important policy issues, which we haven't talked about since forever. You know, certainly since the days of repeal and replace. Let's just put it that way.
So the
president this week had a huddle up with Senate and House Democrats, meaning Schumer and, or more appropriately, Chuck and Nancy, to talk about a $2 trillion infrastructure bill. So what? What do you think about that? I mean, so what?
This is so Washington and so Trumpism. And here's what I mean by that. On matters of taxes and health care and college tuition, those are real day-to-day issues people feel, right? Infrastructure is a jobs issue and an infrastructure issue, but here's why it's so Trumpian right now and so Washington. There is an infrastructure bill, an authorization bill that moves every 5 to 6 years, always, regardless of who's in charge of Congress or the White House, always. It authorizes the nation's spending for infrastructure for the next 5 to 6 years. It just happens to be expiring next year. So this is nothing more than the routine work of the Congress and the White House, but Trump is going to define it as a 5-year, $2 trillion bill. Well, of course it is. It always is. So the fact that Schumer and Pelosi are saying we'll work with you on it, of course they will, because it always ends up being a bipartisan bill to fund the nation's infrastructure. The only issues that ever hold up the infrastructure bill are in two primary areas: labor, what's the requirements around unions or not, and then how to pay for the project. And that always comes down to, are there user fees that get put on different modes of transportation, think electric vehicles or multimodal or high-speed rail, or do we raise the federal gas tax? Those are the only things that ever hold up this grand infrastructure bill. We've seen them 100 times before. We're going to see it next year. It's not a grand bargain, and it's not Trump's biggest accomplishment. Sorry, but I was on the Transportation Committee. This is nonsense that they're making a big deal about this.
This is when someone looks at the camera and goes, sucker. I mean, really? Really? Are you kidding me? So then, because I was about to quote you, and now this is almost laughable. Shelley Moore Capito, Republican from West Virginia, member of Congress, Senator Capito said, quote, "The likelihood of that happening," meaning an infrastructure bill, "at $2 trillion, just on the face of what I saw, is pie in the sky. But I'd love to have a big infrastructure bill." Well, dude, you've got one every 5 years. All you need to do is work out
That's right.
exactly where you're
going. Yeah, and she's right. It won't end up $2 trillion because you can't pay for $2 trillion worth of infrastructure. But it'll be a big, beautiful infrastructure bill. It's going to happen. It doesn't matter who's president. It's happening.
Well, then, as they say, moving on. That's so you're right. That is so Washington. That is so Washington. Well, before I let you get out of here, I do want to touch on something that, you have had a very, I think, strong voice on over the last couple of years. And we touched a little bit on it in the beginning of our conversation. But I want to peel back a little bit of that onion on the character and the nature of our country, where we're going, and what it looks like and what it will look like going forward. And I specifically reference what we're seeing now as a surge in anti-Semitic attacks, not just here in the United States, but globally. Certainly the Poway Synagogue attacks in California last week, this by a 19-year-old kid who is charged with one count of murder with a hate crime, special circumstance, and gun allegations. David, as a member who's been, in the town hall meetings certainly been around the country and sort of as a member, you always have your finger out there on the pulse and in the air to sort of get the temperature on things. What's your assessment of what's behind this, irrespective of Trump in one sense? Because, yes, he does stoke that flame. But is it that easy? Was it that easy just to have someone stand up and say there's, good people on both sides? I mean, is that enough? Was it the veil so thin between our past and our future in terms of that ugly part of our history that we find ourselves here the way we do?
I think this is a conversation we'll be having for hundreds of years, because there are dark spots of human nature that will always emerge. Two things I would say that are unique for the chapter we're living in. One is this remarkable tool of social media that has allowed like-minded people who subscribe to these darker approaches to humanity, if you will, when it comes to race, gender, LGBT, whatever it may be, the ability of them to connect and organize has been increased. Bias we all suffer from with our own politics, as benign as politics are when it comes to more grave matters like we're talking, they find confirmation bias in like-minded individuals who have racism or misogyny in their hearts. But I would say there's also an element of political leadership that has changed. And when I say political leadership, I would also say voices in media that are willing to accommodate some of these theories. And what I mean by that is not in pushing the narratives, if you will, directly around issues of race and gender, but in identifying the causes of one's victimhood and in pointing the finger at the reasons for your angst. Mm-hmm. Like we know what creates the greatest anxiety for a lot of people is either economic disparity, economic uncertainty, the disparate social circumstances of different communities. And what we have seen in political voices recently, and yes, Trump reflects many of these, but certainly not all, is to paint this narrative of grievance politics and say, hey, if you're struggling with your kid getting into college, or you're struggling with debt, or you're struggling with upward mobility, it's because of these multicultural elitists who have implemented a social agenda that is leaving, let's say in this case, the poor white man behind. And for most people, there's not a receptive audience. I hear that and say, that's stupid. That's nonsense. In fact, it's historically wrong and it's contemporarily wrong. However, if I'm that 300-pound guy at the foot of the bed that Donald Trump talked about on his computer in his mom's basement, maybe that resonates with me. And it identifies a culprit to my grievance, and it allows me to then assign almost an identity politics to my grievance, which does further these moments then. And then, Michael, I would also just say that there are outright moments like the president's articulation of the issues in Charlottesville or his unwillingness to condemn certain acts that you do have to question. You know, was the San Diego shooting and somehow influenced by what the shooter saw in Pittsburgh? And apparently he also tried to light a mosque on fire as well.
Right.
What voices did he hear that encouraged him that perhaps that behavior is justifiable? Not okay, but in his mind, justifiable because he has a grievance against his current situation.
Yeah, and that's where in the past I think we've always relied on the president, for example, to be that voice
right.
of reason, that compelling voice that called us to something higher, something greater, the better angels in ourselves.
That's right.
And absent that, certainly with this president, it does, I think, fall more on the rest of us in our communities.
That's right.
and across the nation to be more vocal, more vigilant, and aspirational in that sense, if we still believe in this crazy experiment called the United States of America. And if we do, then we have to act as if we do, I think.
We do. And these voices of leadership will not always be successful. It's not a cure-all, but it is a marker for us as a society. Right? When Bush 43, after 9/11, goes and speaks to the Muslim community directly and says, "You're not our enemy." When John McCain questioned about Barack Obama's faithfulness to America, cuts off the questioner and says, "No, he's a good man."
Right.
Those moments aren't perfectly successful in righting the ship of, in those cases, Republican politics, if you will, but it is a marker of leadership. And we haven't seen those markers of leadership in this administration.
Well, we certainly have a marker of leadership in you, good sir. And I appreciate your time of public service. I especially appreciate your current voice of public service out there. Keep it going. Keep it strong. And continued success and all the best with the new family and all the good things that are going on for you.
Well, you as well, Michael. Appreciate everything you contribute to the conversation as well.
You got it. All right, folks. That does it for today's engagement, as it were. Such a pleasure having former Congressman David Jolly on the podcast. Please don't forget to check us out on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get your podcasts on. Do that download thing because it does a good thing for me. It makes me smile, and, you know, why not? So, all right, guys, we'll catch you all later. Take care. Be good. Till next time.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.